Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaaronshow.com. On Twitter, we're at Matt Aaron Show, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You can follow us over there and get all our updates and see who we've recently had on. You could follow us at the Matthew Aaron Show over on Facebook. You go to the search bar, you type in the Matthew Aaron Show, and you will then follow us over there. You'll get all our updates over there. So at Matt Aaron Show, and then at Facebook on Twitter, and then at Facebook, the Matthew Aaron Show. You can also subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. We've been doing really good numbers at both. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in and having the podcast directly sent to you via subscription over there. It is free, free of charge. The podcast has always been free of charge. I don't do Patreon. I don't do any gimmicks to make you pay any money. I give this to you from me to you, a gift, free. today, my guest is going to be Gary Cole, and we're going to talk to Gary about his illustrious career and his new film, Darkness Falls. But also, I want to remind people, you can listen to us at our new home, Anchor.fm, Anchor.fm, the Matthew Aaron Show, and they are our new distributor, our new podcast home, and we want to thank them. They've figured out a way to, with a little advertising on the show, to monetize our show a bit. And it's just basically to pay the website bills. I don't make any money off that. So here we are today with Gary Cole, Darkness Falls. And he's a Chicagoan. He's a Steppenwolf guy. And I have a lot to talk to him about. Hopefully we can get through it all. Here we go. All right, everybody. I'm here with Gary Cole and Darkness Falls, which is his new film. You can stream everywhere starting today. It's Friday, June 12th. Starting today, you can stream it anywhere. It's on all the on-demand outlets, Comcast, Xfinity in Chicago here, which is what I use, and also on Amazon, on iTunes. And Gary, when I told everybody that you were going to do this interview, I got sent like 50 questions for you. I mean, I've never, and we've interviewed some big people. I've never seen so many questions. People, especially in Chicago, I think because the show has a huge Chicago audience, they love you. And I noticed you're not on social media. You're smarter than all of us. So I was just shocked. I'm like, maybe this is why they have no way of getting a hold of Gary. He's closed himself off from the world.
Could be. Maybe that's why nobody knows anything. I don't leave it hanging out there.
Yeah. Well, I want to get into, first I want to talk about Darkness Falls. And then that'll go into some of the questions. Darkness Falls, this is not your first time playing an evil, evil dude. I'm not really giving anything away. It's in the trailer even. It's out there that you play this murderous mastermind, if you will. What attracted you to the material? Was it offered to you? And then I have a question for you about playing a villain, but go ahead first with what attracted you to the material.
Yeah, we actually shot it a couple years ago. So it was at the time I was still, I think, finishing up Veep. So it was during a break between seasons, and it was shot here in Los Angeles. And I read the script, and
What happened? Uh-oh. We're going to have to hold on a second, folks. I lost Gary. I'm going to call him. Okay, great. I'm guessing you're in Los Angeles, because that's where I have the most, like when you're in someone's house, the most signal problems happen to be in Los Angeles for me. Okay, so you were telling us you received the script, you read the script.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I liked it for a couple of reasons. It was something that I haven't had a lot of chance to do. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, I've played a few villains here and there, but this was almost so, you know, bordering on sadistic almost, which was, you know, in a weird way attractive to me, because I've never done anything quite like that. And so, you know, it, as time goes on in your career and opportunities present themselves, you know, you kind of go, I kind of refer to everything as math. You know, I said, am I going to get a chance to do this again? You know what I mean? Is this something that's going to surface for me again? And I the answer to that question was probably, you know, slim.
Yeah.
It was a small movie. I liked the script. It kind of reminded me. It was so kind of a straight ahead bad guy, good guy thing, like that was more maybe prominent in the mid to late 70s. And so I took a look at the director's work that he had. I just got kind of a flash reel of several of a couple of things that he did. And I really liked visually, there was a lot of action scenes in it, and just not just action, but a bunch of stuff that he had done previously in another film. And I thought it was really interesting, and unusual. And all of the production team, it has a very European feel because yeah. Julian is from Paris, and so is a screenwriter. So it had a different kind of a vibe, even though it was set, you know, they intentionally wanted to deal with an American location and Los Angeles in particular. So it seemed like, you know, something that I would enjoy doing. And I did, you know, I had a good time. He was great. And it was fun to be involved in a part like that, which, you know, it's been a long time since I played somebody that, you know.
I was going to say the last.
The wall twisted, but.
Yeah, the last time I recall that was American Gothic.
Sure.
And you played basically the embodiment of Satan, I like to tell people, when it comes to that show.
Right. We always joke that he wasn't Satan, but he was. He definitely was Satan's right-hand man.
Yeah, right.
Driver, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah,
yeah, right. And you know, I talked to David Morse about this, and he said something to me, and, you know, you two are much better actors than I am and much more acclaimed than I am, so it's always great hearing this kind of stuff. And I wonder if you agree with David, because David's played a lot of villains, and he says you got to play them straight. You got to play them like they're innocent. They're not bad guys to David when David plays them. Is that how you look at these roles?
Yes. Yeah. You know, and I mean, there can be, depending on what the script is, this character had what would be the word? I agree with what he's saying, because you can't lean into it, especially if it's, you know, if the plot presents to you that they are, in fact, you know, just, you know, a good or a good or not good or evil or not evil being.
Yeah.
You know, but in order to play that, you can't lean into it. Then you've got melodrama, you know, and usually that's not what you're looking for unless you're doing an old melodrama where you, you know, you're twisting your mustache and you want everybody to boo when you come on the screen. You know, so you're believing in your reasoning. You're believing in you're rationalizing every heinous act that you're doing, because either you feel that you've been victimized by the world, or you have a justification to do it, or on and on and on. So I agree with them there. This character, other than some villains, I think at times, not a lot, but had a, you know, I mean, what's the word to describe it? I can't think of a word. What I'm getting at is he wasn't above, you know, twisting the knife once it's in.
Yeah.
And enjoying that a little bit. And we see some of that, not all the time, but, you know, and he wasn't outwardly aggressive. In fact, most of the way I did it, the way it was actually presented, was he was actually very soft spoken. You know, the actions were more ugly than anything necessarily he was, you know, saying or, you know, or confronting somebody with. You know,
yeah.
He actually had a reason for everything he was doing, at least in his own mind. So, I think David is exactly correct.
And you guys are both great.
You never want to lean into something if it's not necessary, because that then you're just looking at somebody that's working too hard.
Well, that leads me to Fatal Vision. Was that your approach with Fatal Vision too? Because obviously there's a lot of controversy that surrounded that film.
Sure. Even more so in that, because it was a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the script was obviously had made, you know, I mean, I think the way it was presented, they had made their decision, right, ultimately, that he was guilty. So I literally in that played him as if he was innocent, you know.
Yeah.
And rather than somebody who was concealing something. Now, there's two complications to that. One is that somebody who was capable of that could very well believe, because it was such a horrific thing, but it wasn't strangers, it was his wife and children. So therefore, psychologically, how far can how do you reconcile that unless there's something, you know, going on mentally, which you're allowed to like live with. So it's possible. My point is, it's possible he could have done that. McDonald could have done that and believed he was innocent simultaneously.
Yeah.
Just to survive himself.
Mm.
Or he's a brilliant, you know, psychopathic liar and was able to survive with it. My playing it in front of a camera as a story, you know, and not, you know, obviously not living it, but in order for it to be, you know, a story on film, I chose to actually play him innocent because I didn't want to appear to be somebody who was concealing something every time he talked to somebody or every situation he was in. And if you'll notice in that film, there is no moment other than the recreations of the murders, which do both versions, which do his version where he said hippies came into the house, and then the law enforcement version, which said he's responsible. There's no other moment in that film where he is alone. He's always with somebody else. There's no moment of, you know, secret reflection, or you never see him in a situation where he's not, where somebody's eyes aren't on him. And so then you can't really know.
So, you know, and listener David Grove, he asked if you ever thought about his motives or his conviction. So is that something you never even bothered thinking about? Did you distance yourself from having an opinion on the case just so you could play this character the way you thought you wanted to play him?
No, I had theories.
Yeah.
Like everybody did. But I didn't. In order to play it, I thought the best thing I could do was to just play the story that he said and tell, you know, this, you know, and especially when he's interrogated, this is the story he, you know, he gives the law enforcement, the three people broke into the house. And then when they don't believe him, that his reaction to that is, you know, it's complicated. It's not only why don't you believe me, but now he's backed into a corner because now it's his ass on the line as well.
Yeah.
We had a lot of information. I mean, we had, you know, they had a lot. They had crime scene photos. They had transcripts, you know, the real stuff. They had, you know, they had a lot of information. You know, I talked to a lot of people that were involved in the project but I never took that into what I was going to do to play it. I simply played it as somebody who was innocent.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And then the story takes care of itself.
Yeah,
and the viewer can make that.
And to ask David Preibel's question, David asked, what do you think of McDonald's endless series of appeals, and do you ever hear from Jeffrey McDonald?
No, I never. I mean, there was, you know, when we were doing the miniseries. I'm not sure how soon after the book was published. I want to say it's a couple of years, but I could be wrong on that. I think the book was published in 82 or 81. And we were shooting by 84. He was already suing McGinnis. He was also, I think, trying to sue NBC before the production began. So, you know, it didn't seem like an open door.
Yeah, right. You guys weren't going to be pen pals.
Well, not only that. I mean, I literally was just in the business. I mean, you're talking about an actor that basically came from Chicago.
Yeah.
From the theater and wound up in this thing. I didn't know anything about television or, you know, any kind of, for whatever reason.
But what a cast. What a cast to work with.
No, it was, I mean, it never would happen today, probably. I don't think anybody unknown would get that part. Although they had, you know, they had several well-established, you know, almost iconic actors in it already. So it's not like they didn't have anybody that viewers, didn't know. It's just that at the center of it was this part. And I think one of the reasons is because the part was, you know, it certainly wasn't a heroic part.
Right.
You know, it was not a attractive part, but, you know, my eagerness was not worried about that. You know, talk about somebody that was just, you know, I mean, I was perfectly content in Chicago, but when this opportunity, and not only that, I mean, it kind of blew my mind that all of a sudden now I'm going to be working with Andy Griffith and Carl Malden.
Yeah, right, on the waterfront. Yeah, on the waterfront.
I didn't really believe it.
Yeah, right.
Until I was, and when I got in a room with them all, we had a read-through of it. Actually, Andy Griffith was not there, but I read with Carl and Eve Marie Saint, and it blew my mind. I mean, it was just like, what am I? I'm sitting here with, you know, film legends here, you know? I mean, it's just like, and it's, so it took a while to just kind of, I was still in awe of them the whole time, but I mean, you know, at some point you settle down and you do the work, but still it was for a first experience, literally. I mean, I had done 2 weeks on a TV movie before that, but and that was, you know, that was certainly thrilling for me, but this was different.
This was around the time the Steppenwolf crew started taking off into film and TV, if I remember right. I mean, Billy Peterson had to live and die in L.A. around that time. Malkovich was getting out there.
I mean, early to mid-80s, everybody was that kind of explosion of...
Yeah.
You know, we were all sitting around a bar in Chicago in 1980, and then in 1985, 86, we're seeing each other on television or in movies.
Yeah, that had
to be... It was strange.
That had to be the best time to be in Chicago, though, the early to mid-80s for film and for theater. It just seemed like so much iconic stuff was coming out at that time. Dave Hemmingson, a listener and guest of the show numerous times, he created Whiskey Cavalier, Kitchen Confidential, Don't Trust the Bitch in Apartment 23. He had a four-part question for you. He's a big fan, Gary. What is your favorite role?
Well, I always when I try to determine that, I always go, is it the one that came off the best, or is it the one that was the most fun to do?
Well, I guess which one are you most recognized for, and which one for you?
Well,
was your favorite?
Right, I would say, but at the top of that list for both that answers yes to both questions is Talladega Nights.
Okay.
You know, the fun I had making that, and also as I look at it as a movie, even though it's a comedy, it is that character and all those characters. I think it's really, it's a script that really works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a good, you know, it moves well. There's not a lot of, you know, I don't think there's any lag time on it, but it was such a joy to do it. It was so fun. And working with Will Ferrell and Adam McKay in particular was, you know, I learned a great deal, and it was just one of those things that felt right all the time.
Mm.
And then when I see it, I go, yeah, it pretty much worked, you know, because sometimes you can feel like, oh, this feels great. And then you see it and you go, wow, I get the good news is it felt great. The bad news is it doesn't look great.
Well, Adam McKay is great. He's always given us time, and he's a really good man, and he's really funny.
Yeah, I'm so happy that his career is where it is because he deserves it because he can do anything.
Yeah,
he's proven that. But I knew that when I was working on that with him that I was in extremely good hands, and he really crafted that. I mean, he helped me so much. I remember one of the first things I did, if not the first thing I did, was the scene in the classroom with the you still there? I heard it.
Yeah, no, I'm here. Yeah,
you're good. Okay.
Questions are still coming in for you.
Got it. Where he's talking to this class before, you know, while his son is there, and he would just, you know, Adam would just throw dialogue at me, you know, from the back behind the camera. So he's like a writing machine back there, even when, you know, after the script is written.
That's great. So but Dave would then ask you, what part did you pass on that you regret, and which part would you want to play in a heartbeat?
I don't have any real definite answers to that because I can't imagine that there's anything that I passed on that became something that I regretted.
That's great.
In other words, if it was something I regretted, then I would have, if I had a chance for it, I certainly would have gone for it. I mean, there was a lot of things I went, you know, a lot of movies and stuff like that. Now they all blend together that you wanted to try to get into that, you know, you never, you know, those, they, you know, you fell short. There's a bunch of those. But nothing I said, nah, I don't want to do this. And then it became something quite successful. I don't think that exists.
So is there a part that you're looking to play in the future? It doesn't have to be like an actual like person or drawn out character already, but is there something you're looking to do that you haven't done?
I don't know. I mean, it's weird. You know, the business has gone through a lot of evolutions and you know, I tend to just not really think about what is possible or to look for things that, you know, don't really exist in any form. I really just respond to material, and that's just kind of, you know, over time, that seems to be the more, you know, real state of mind to be in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I don't have, I guess I'm not that, for an actor, I'm not that abstract, actually, I think. I think I'm more literal. I'm a more literal person.
Yeah.
And I'm more instinctual than anything else. So that, you know, I'm not a writer. I've tried to dabble with that, but it's just not, I don't think it's part of me. So I react to creations that I see. And then, you know, what I do is try to interpret them. So,
do you think I'm going to piggyback on Dave's question here? Do you think there's a return to theater for you in the future?
Well, let's hope theater returns.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
yeah, that's true.
That's at the moment that's kind of a very melancholy state of mind for me. I was actually I was set to do a play at Steppenwolf, which I would have begun rehearsal for on May 5th.
Oh my gosh.
And we would be in performances right now, but
you say which play it was? Which play was it?
What's that?
Which play was it?
It was I think it's, what was it called? Catch as Catch Can, is that the name of it? It was the summer slot at Steppenwolf.
That's a good slot.
yeah. And, you know, and so that went away. And I hope and there's a chance that it may get done, you know, later on, maybe season or two down the road. But, you know, the question is, what is going to be normal for theaters in general?
Yeah.
I mean, I assume at some point there will be some form of theater. I can't see it being evaporated, but, you know, it's hard to think about right now because anytime, you know, as we know, anything that has a gathering of people is just, you know.
Well,
it's on pause till further notice.
Let's hope it happens, because I love Amy Morton, and I know she was going to direct it, and
I
think that would have been great. I have a question for you about Blockers. First of all, I think it's one of the most underrated comedies of the last few years. It's got a lot of heart. It's really funny. How did they convince you to do a nude scene in Blockers? How did this happen?
Well,
how comfortable were you?
I was fine.
Yeah?
Because I'll go back 25 years or whatever. You know, I started doing theater in Chicago.
Yeah.
We started, Amy and Billy Peterson and I with some other people started a little theater called Remains Theater. This was before I was in Steppenwolf, or Billy or Amy were in Steppenwolf. This was in 1978, around there.
Okay.
So we did, you know, and we did midnight shows. We did weird shows. We did a lot of weird stuff. And some of it involved, you know, nudity of various situation.
So you did like hair and
I have no, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I found myself on stage or in front of a camera in all various states of undress and or compromised visual position. So this was nothing to me. I mean, I thought it was funny.
Yeah, it was.
I read it.
It was.
I particularly liked the homage to Jurassic Park, you know, that she built in there. So I didn't have any big, you know, thing. And I know it's a big, you know, and when I had a conversation with the director,
yeah,
she was talking, you know, and it was like, I understand why people are are very delicate about it, especially in these times. Right. And because they don't want to get on a set and then all of a sudden have it go sideways and have somebody say they were going to do something and now they're not going to do it. Right. And I assured her, I said, I don't, you know, it's funny to me. It makes me laugh. I don't care. I'm not, first of all, and what am I? I mean, I'm pushing into the late innings here age-wise.
No.
So it's not like I'm worried about my image, you know. And so I said, you know, if you want a funny scene, I'm up for it and whatever. And I believe it was funny.
It was.
It's not the most normal thing to do on a you know, for a 12-hour day. But, you know, it's worth some laughs. What the hell? It was done professionally.
It was done,
you know, nobody felt uncomfortable. It was actually, as I remember, we shot so late. So by the time we were actually less than halfway done, people were like falling asleep anyway, because it was like, I think we shot it till dawn. That's because the call was early in the, you know, in the afternoon or something. So,
well,
so, you know, no biggie to me. I mean, I thought it was great.
It was just, it was different. It was like, you know what that scene said to me? And it was one of the many things I took away because I loved the movie. And I was just like, Gary Cole, he will continue to surprise you. I think that's one thing we can say about a lot of your roles over the years, is there are not many that are similar to another.
Yeah. And I looked at it like that. It had been a while since I had been in a movie that I knew people were going to see.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of movies that I knew were going to end up nowhere except the director's desk drawer, you know.
Yeah.
Because you do a lot of independent movies, and most of them never see the light of day. This was going to get a release. The one thing I wanted to know was who I was going to play this with. And when I found out it was Gina, I went, oh, well, fine.
Yeah, no one's saying no to that.
Done a lot of great work. And
yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, that was, you know, and so we were set. I hadn't worked with Leslie, but I knew Leslie, and I was a big fan of hers. I knew because she's Judd's wife, and so,
yeah.
You know, I've worked for Judd. I've done a couple readings with, and I'm a huge fan of his, too.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
I'm a huge fan of Mad TV. And so I thought they had, you know, all the elements for a successful comedy. And so, you know, I felt, what the hell, I'll get in on the party.
Well, speaking of one of those smaller films that I think everyone should see, and I think you've done two films that are kind of like under the radar, everyone should see, which is A Simple Plan, and then also Last Rites of Joe May with Dennis Farina, mm-hmm. Which is a great Chicago story.
Yeah, I was so happy I got to do that, and it was even more when he passed away shortly. I don't remember how it was. That was a big shock.
Yeah.
But I was, Dennis was in the early, you know, that period we're talking about, the early to mid 80s.
That's right, yeah. Thief.
I was in a play at Steppenwolf called Tracers that he was in. Excuse me. And at the time, he was still a Chicago police detective. So he was doing double duty. He was, he would do a shift in the at night while we were rehearsing, and he rehearsed during the day, and then he flipped his schedule, you know, and he'd do the show at night and work during the day. And he was such a natural actor, you know. And that script for him was—I just thought it was such a perfect blend of, you know, his personality, and it was also a look at Chicago, and not the normal look at Chicago that you see, you know, not the
right,
not the Michigan Avenue Chicago, you know, the more fringe Chicago. And I thought that was captured well, and I loved it. It was kind of reminded me a lot of Mammoth stuff. It was Joe's script, but it had that, you know, had that feel, and it was a great character for Dennis. I was just thrilled to do it with him because I just had a great time doing it.
Yeah, it was great. I hope people go check that out as well. I wanted to bring up, we had Rachel Axler on the show a few weeks ago, and she's a good friend of my producing partner, and Rachel, of course, wrote for Veep, which you did, I believe, what, 5-6 seasons of, right?
Right. I did. There were 7 seasons, and I came in season 2.
Now, and you also played the vice president on The West Wing. Two totally different roles, of course, in political right. satires. What though is it from Veep, and what is it from The West Wing? What are the two? What are the things you'll take away from each of those shows?
The one thing I think is that I. If done well, if you got a great writing staff, you know, which both of those shows obviously did, politics is a great backdrop. And the reason it is because, to me, in television, drama, and or comedy, one thing that helps you along the way is stakes. How high are the stakes? And in both of those situations, the stakes couldn't be higher because of the positions that these people hold. So that's a great foundation to work from, comedy or drama. Because it's like the end of the line, right? When they say the buck stops here, these are the rooms they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so these are the people that are, you know, living those lives and having to deal with that responsibility, whether they do it competently, like a lot of The West Wing, or they're total imbeciles like you know.
I feel like you and
the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I feel like you and Kevin Dunn probably had great chemistry on and off set for
yeah.
Veep. I feel like you two probably made each other laugh a lot. Is that a fair? Is that a fair assumption?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Kevin, first of all, Kevin and I had known each other for 30 years before
wow.
we did that together. We did work one time on an HBO pilot that never got off, that didn't get picked up. And that was probably in maybe 2000, something like 99, 2000, around there. But we had known each other forever in Chicago. We never worked together in Chicago, but we were in the same taverns regularly in Chicago. You know, and I've known him, and also Kevin and I are what are those when we were back in the day, and we still occasionally, but I mean it's not so much anymore because we either get a phone call or we don't. But back in the day when we were making the rounds everywhere for a decade out here in LA, or even in Chicago, we were always showing up at the same audition for the same part. You call it the usual suspects. When you start going to auditions and you've been around, you're not 25 anymore and you're 35, 40, and 45. It's the usual suspects, right? That wind up in a room, you know, vying for one part. Now, the same thing for Veep. We were there together reading, and I think Kevin said, I was always just reading for Kent. He also read for Kent, but then suggested, I think it was his suggestion, that he read for Ben.
Yeah, good suggestion.
So when we started, we were like, and also we were the two new guys, right? Not only in reality, because they had been shooting for a year, but we were in the story, we were the two new guys, because these were the two guys that were actually working in the White House. Because we were working for the president that you never saw, President Hughes.
Yeah.
That's how they kind of filtered us into the story. So there was a lot of reality there. That we were new to everybody, you know, on some level.
But it's also good on some level that you guys had experience with each other previous to the show. It makes it easier to believe that you guys were working together for...
Because you look at those two characters and you know that they've seen it all. They've been through several administrations, they were doing. And they're totally, you know... They're jaded in their own ways, but they've just seen it all, and they're just like, whatever.
That's the perfect show and the perfect comedy. I just have two little quick ones for you here, and then I'll let you go. Office Space, of course, famously, one of my favorite stories about you is you started hearing about, and I think I heard Mike Judge tell this story or somebody, you started hearing about Office Space because no one saw it in theaters, and it became this cult hit. When you were doing a play at Steppenwolf, right? And
right.
People were barking lines at you outside of Steppenwolf from the movie.
Yeah.
But my question...
People yelling across the street about TPS reports.
So that was true.
And I was like, I was like, wow. I thought this movie tanked. You know.
It's funny.
Which it did in the theater, but...
Yeah.
You know, but... It stayed alive.
Yeah.
On video.
Did anyone get to keep the stapler from the movie? Does Steven have it?
I have no idea.
You don't know?
I'm sure there was more than one.
Yeah. I would hope.
I didn't walk away with one. I know that. So you'd have to confirm that with Steve.
Have you gotten anything good from doing a movie or a TV show? Any piece of memorabilia?
the occasional wardrobe or items or a nice suit of clothes.
That's good.
They were generous on Veep. They let me walk away with a suit of clothes.
Oh, that's
after
good.
7 years. It was like, yeah. Who else is going to
wear them, especially after Corona and COVID and everything?
Right.
No one wants to wear used clothes. My buddy and I, you'll solve this. We assume that the way you approached Brady Bunch was you saw Robert Reed's performance, you really got Robert Reed's performance, and you decided you were going to play Robert Reed playing Mike Brady. True or false?
Correct.
Oh, wow. True. Is that real?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
Oh, my God. Well, I feel great now.
But I think that was the point. I mean, that was the point of doing
it. I think so,
movies,
yeah.
And that's what Betty wanted. I mean, if you look at the way it's shot, you look at the set, it's exactly, I mean, there's not a bad Formica table out of place. I mean, it's the same thing. So you wanted those the memory of those actors, the original actors. You wanted that, you know, and so I, yeah, that's all I was after. I mean, the only other thing I wanted to
Well, you nailed it.
was to make him, because the script was, you know, was really funny, was that I wanted to make him as two things simultaneously. I wanted to be as vacant and vague as possible, yet with this uber TV dad sitcom confidence that was, you know, that you know, they were all the same dad, you know, all of those TV dads. They, you know, they all meant well, they were responsible, they listened to their kids, they had an answer for everything. And, you know, and they were a little bit bumbling, but whoever's idea was to leave the Bradys in the 70s and move everybody else ahead to the 90s, that's what scored that movie. That's why that movie worked.
I agree, and you nailed it, and it was perfect, and people remember it. Well, I want to thank you. It's taken 297 episodes, but I finally got you on here. And you've been somebody I've been wanting to get from day one, so that goes all the way back to, I think, 2011, 2012, so I'm glad proof to everybody out there that it will happen if you keep working for it. Before I let you go, anywhere in Chicago that people that you really like that people should go check out for a drink or for a meal?
Oh, boy. It's weird because I'm just kind of like back and forth there. I'm trying to think of a lot of the places that I really, you know, like remember and were fond of probably aren't there anymore.
Well, I would assume you're probably going up and down Halstead because of Steppenwolf, right?
Right. Well, I'll tell you this. It's still there and it's an icon. If you want just a little bit of Wrigleyville ambience and it's that looks still a little bit old school, check out the Ginger Man Tavern on Clark Street.
Wow.
Probably, it's basically at the corner of Clark and Racine.
That's a hidden gem. That's great.
Yeah, that's I spent more hours than I care to admit there, but they were.
You just gave away your watering hole.
They were all fond memories. Yeah, it's still there, and it basically looks the same as it did in whenever I got there in, you know, 77 or 78, and I'm sure it looked. It looks like that in 1968.
That's so awesome. Well, Darkness Falls is on VOD now. It's on demand. It's on Amazon. It's on iTunes. It's everywhere you can see the movies right now. And, Gary, thank you so much for doing this and taking some time out of your day.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Gary Cole. Have a good day.
All right. See you later.